Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is someone we've been waiting for a long time to get on the program. Arianna Huffington will be joining us to talk about her new book, Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe, and What You Need to Know to End the Madness. Arianna Huffington joining us today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The question is on the adoption of the joint resolution. All in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed, no.
Last week, in a historic bipartisan voice vote, the Senate took a major step in turning back the FCC's decision to relax longstanding media ownership rules and allow media companies to own both a TV or radio station and a daily newspaper in the same city. The near-unanimous vote to pass the resolution of disapproval came in response to intense public pressure, including a 250,000 letters to Congress since the FCC's December vote opposing the new rules. Only three senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and both senators from Georgia, Johnny Isaacson and Saxby Chambliss, voted against Senate Joint Resolution 28. The resolution was introduced in March by Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota and then-Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi. After the vote, Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington took the floor.
The ownership of broadcast and print media does touch on some of the core values Americans hold for freedom of speech, open and diverse viewpoints, to have vibrant economic competition from a variety of sources and local diversity. And attention to diversity and localism really have served our economy well, but has also provided us a good civics lesson. And so these opportunities where we hear from small companies, when we hear from minorities, when we hear from women, are the types of diversity that we want to protect, and we did that tonight.
An identical measure has been introduced in the House by Representatives Jay Inslee and Dave Reichert, both from Washington. The House has until the end of the current session to pass the resolution, and momentum is building for a vote. President Bush has threatened to veto the resolution despite its widespread bipartisan support.
The Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation started in 1985 as a response to the sensationalized and derogatory coverage of the AIDS crisis in the New York Post. Since those early days of protesting at the Post's front door, GLAAD has gone Hollywood. The organization serves entertainment and news media companies as a major resource to promote fairness and equality for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered community. Rashad Robinson is GLAAD's Senior Director of Media Programs.
We do everything from having high-level meetings with CNN and MSNBC and Meet the Press producers, having editorial board meetings with folks at USA Today and New York Times, to having meetings with Hollywood producers.
GLAAD works with local advocates to create media plans to educate the public and the media around hate crimes and marriage equality, or to change policy at newspapers to recognize same-sex relationships. Robinson thinks of media holistically, with all its different platforms of information, culture, sports, religion, and entertainment.
As much as we want to influence what is talked about and how our community is portrayed on Meet the Press, we also need to work with Access Hollywood. We also need to understand that people get their news from Oprah and Dr. Phil and Tyra Banks' show just as much as they get their news from the editorial pages of the New York Times, and making sure that we have staff focused on all those different areas.
Robinson says that our laws don't always reflect or move as quickly as people have changed across the country. But due to greater visibility in the media, American opinions about gays and lesbians have altered over the years.
If you look at Gallup polling on gay and lesbian issues, 90% of Americans believe that gays and lesbians deserve protection in the workplace. That's a tremendous change. You know, these are real shifts in public education. It's because people were out there telling their stories.
Robinson gives the example of the annual GLAAD Awards event that is now televised. Every year after the show, his office is inundated with emails.
To get those type of messages of wow, I feel better about myself, That's the power of the media. It's an equalizer. It gives people the ability to see themselves reflected. And I think that in many ways, as much as our work is about educating folks who are not yet on our side, it's also about empowering the community and allowing the community to see themselves on the small screen and the large and feel better about who they are.
Rashad Robinson will be speaking about GLBT issues at the National Conference for Media Reform in Minneapolis on June 6th through 8th. For more information about GLAAD, go to glaad.org. And to find out more about the National Conference for Media Reform, go to freepress.net/conference. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today needs no introduction to most of our listeners, someone that many Americans are familiar with. Arianna Huffington is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, a nationally syndicated columnist and the author of no less than 12 books. We're here today to discuss her latest book on the state of politics in America in general. The book is Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe, and What You Need to Know to End the Madness. Well, that title really, that's like a chapter in some books I've read. Thank you very much for joining us, Arianna.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Now, we're taping this a week and a half before going on air for the Memorial Day weekend, and I don't know what the state of the world will be 10 or 11 days from now, but I do want to ask you before we get into the book about a story that's been breaking the last few days involving you and presumptive candidate John McCain concerning whether or not he voted for George W. Bush in the 2000 presidential election. For some of our listeners who might not be familiar with this story, could you just tell what happened?
Well, in January 2001, before the inauguration, I was at a dinner in Los Angeles, and so was John McCain and Cindy McCain. In fact, the dinner at Candace Bergen's house was in their honor. And during dinner, John McCain was, as we all knew at the time, he was going to be highly critical of George Bush and of how he had been treated in South Carolina. And at one point, one of the guests asked him, then how come he voted for him? And he said, I did not. And the reason why I decided to come out and write about it last Monday was because I saw that the media kept giving and will continue to give John McCain a pass on everything, from his confusions about Sunnis and Shias to his comment that we went to war for oil, one thing after another, because the media still thought of John McCain as the man they had fallen in love with in 2000, the maverick, the independent thinker, the man who so abhorred George Bush, he ended up not being able to vote for him. And by writing about that, I could stress how much that John McCain of 2000 had fallen from grace. I mean, I called it, in fact, a kind of Shakespearean fall, because this was a man who indeed was a noble man, a war hero, a real reformer, who, for the sake of getting to the White House, ended up sacrificing his principles on subject after subject after subject.
Now, McCain, of course, denies the charges and has done so on the Bill O'Reilly program on Fox News. I guess it's really your word and those of the people at the party versus his. Is there anyone who was at the party who claims it wasn't said?
Oh, no. In fact, the New York Times did a story on Friday with Brad Whitford and Richard Schiff, who were both at the same table with me, confirming the story. So I don't really think it's a matter of dispute, frankly. I think McCain is picking a fight with the truth, not with me or with Brad Whitford or with Richard Schiff. And it's very consistent with how many people knew he felt at the time.
Well, Arianna Huffington, our guest today. And Arianna, let's go to your book now, if we can. Right is Wrong, just published by Knopf just recently, this month, in fact. And why did you decide to write this book? Why now?
I decided to write the book because as we are all headed towards the November election, I wanted us to be reminded of what this administration had done to the country, and also as to why and how we allowed them to hijack the country and hijack the debate. And so this is not so much a book about what went wrong, but a book about why it went wrong. And in understanding why, I hope we can prevent a third George Bush term. And this is less inevitable than we thought because of the nomination of John McCain, the man who, as you know, in the last chapter of the book, I call the Trojan horse of the right.
And, you know, as I read the book, what's striking is the significant role the media plays in your narrative in terms of the importance of the media coverage and how the media operate to pushing along the right-wing political agenda.
Yes, the first two chapters, as you know, are devoted to the media, and specifically to the ways in which the media enabled the right agenda. The first chapter is called Equal Time for Lies, because one of the obsessions of the media is to prevent every issue as though it has two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, not every issue has two sides, and the truth is not always to be found by splitting the difference between the two sides.
Mm-hmm.
Yet that's how the media tend to present almost everything, whether it's global warming or the war in Iraq, or even creationism and evolution. So, as a result, we have endless media reports on Iraq, which present Iraq as a quote-unquote mixed bag, which is equivalent to going to the doctor and the doctor telling you that you have a brain tumor, but your acne has cleared, and calling the diagnosis a mixed bag.
Our guest today, Arianna Huffington, author of Right is Wrong. This is a recorded show, let me remind everyone. So please sit back, relax, and let me and my fine guest do the yakking today. Your credentials as a media critic, I think, are quite interesting because you have been a journalist and involved in media since you entered the public arena, from my own memory, going back to the early to mid-1990s. And one of the things that's interesting about your path, Arianna Huffington, and is striking about it, which you acknowledge early in the book, is that you were not always a liberal or progressive on the left, whatever nomenclature one wants to use. You, in fact, made your first sort of public prominence, was established as someone who's regarded as a political conservative. Could you just talk a little bit about that transition you made and sort of what you learned in that process?
Yes, absolutely. I learned a lot because that was the time when I was always, you know, caring about the same issues in terms of poverty, in terms of the social problems we were facing, but I really had a very different view of how we would resolve them. At the time, I really thought that the private sector would step up to the plate and be able to address those problems. And then I saw firsthand that this wasn't happening, that this indeed wasn't going to happen, and that we needed the raw power of government appropriations to be able to address the major issues we're facing. And so that was the beginning of my shift away from the Republican Party. And I wrote critical columns during 1996, and by the end of 96, after the conventions and after the election, I began to see that I really could no longer remain in the Republican Party. And that's when I basically left the party and gradually moved to my current progressive populist position.
You know, in America, and I suspect elsewhere in the world for that matter, it's not uncommon for people's political positions and values, but certainly their positions to evolve over time. Traditionally, though, the movement, at least as I've been told about it, is from left to right. People tend to be more progressive or radical in their youth and become more conservative with age. You're going the other direction. Are you alone, or do you think there's sort of a cohort of people who are responding to the world situation in the manner you have?
Well, I think there are many, many more people now than there were 12 years ago when I left the Republican Party, because the Republican Party I left was very different than the Republican Party now, which has really been hijacked by the right.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of disaffected Republicans, a lot of independents who see the Republican Party very differently. I mean, just look at the numbers. 28% of Americans approve of George Bush. That's the hardcore right. The challenge ahead is going to be that 48% say they will vote for John McCain. So there's that 20% of Americans who still have the view of John McCain of 2000 as opposed to the John McCain of 2008. And these are the people that I most especially want them to read my books. If you know anybody who wants to vote for John McCain, please give them the book. I have a money-back guarantee if they read it and at the end of it want a third George Bush term care of John McCain.
The book Arianna Huffington is referring to, Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution and Made Us All Less Safe, and What You Need to Know to End the Madness. In the book, you go through a series of crucial issues after going through your critique of the media. And I want to run through those in the program today, Arianna. But before we get into the specific issues, let's stay with the media for a while, since it seems to play such a central role in the narrative in terms of making right-wing politics more palatable or digestible to people who might not digest the ideas otherwise. You don't just go after the right-wing Fox News, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity's in the book. They certainly get their share of criticism. But in your view, it seems to be a much deeper problem.
Oh, absolutely. I think we all know about Fox News, you know. The deeper problem, as you said, is about the mainstream media. It's about the Bob Woodwards and the Tim Russerts and those who are supposed to be neutral and objective and yet have bought into the right-wing messaging, or, in the case of Bob Woodward, are so trapped in the conventional wisdom and so awed by their access that they miss the big story, as Bob Woodward did. I mean, there was a man who was given almost unlimited access to the White House in the lead up to the war and later, and completely missed the story. You know, I describe Bob Woodward in the book as the dumb blonde of American journalism. And there's a whole section called Russert Watch that deconstructs Tim Russert and Meet the Press, a show which the communications director in Dick Cheney's office, Kathy Martin, had called our best format, the place where they liked to send Cheney and others because they felt they could, quote-unquote, control the message.
No, you have a wonderful transcript from the show that you used to make the case for you with your editorial commentary. And it is striking that the Russert show, as I read that transcript in your analysis, Arianna Huffington, this is a show that could survive in an authoritarian society, a sort of state television.
Yes, you know, that's the whole point. I called Tim Russert the conventional wisdom zombie, because in his questions and in his failure to challenge his guests, he epitomizes the conventional wisdom.
You know, the right-wing media, one thing that strikes me, and this seems to be a change too, there are people, and I think the person who's often identified as this is Ann Coulter, but I think Sean Hannity would probably qualify too. It strikes me, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, that the sort of viciousness and loose relationship with the truth, if not outright lying, that goes on by someone like an Ann Coulter or a Hannity, this is really new levels. We didn't have this in the U.S. media 15 years ago.
Yes, I think it has definitely gotten worse. There's no question about it. And I think it got worse in the lead up to the war. That was really the lowest point of the media's failure to do its job, which is primarily to ferret out the truth. We keep forgetting that. You know, I have a teenage daughter who was editor of her school paper, and in one of these essays that earnest journalism students do, she wrote endlessly about ferreting out the truth, and it reminded me, yeah, you know, that's our job. Mm-hmm. And our job is not to present two sides to each story when the truth is solidly on one side. Our job is not to be stenographers to power, which is what so many of the reporters in the lead-up to the war were. And also, I always want to stress that that there were, of course, some great exceptions, and that's why I included a section in my book called The Honor Roll, mm-hmm. of all the people who got it right in the lead-up to the war, including the Night Reader reporters, including Walter Pincus at the Washington Post. And that's very significant because part of what the conventional wisdom zombies do is to then say, well, we all got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally untrue. We didn't all get it wrong.
You also talk not only about the zombie conventional wisdom, you use the term zombie lies to talk about these mistruths that don't ever go away.
Yes, exactly. And that's also absolutely amazing. The way certain zombie lies, no matter how many times you keep basically tearing them down, reappear and are full of new life. And we see that again when it comes to looking to the people who are completely discredited around the war for solutions as to where to move for, how to move forward. You know, the fact that Bill Kristol was hired by the New York Times to have a column, the fact that Richard Perle was asked by the New York Times to give us his views on how to move out of Iraq or how to resolve what's happening in Iraq, and was described quite simply as a foreign policy expert. It's just an indication of the lack of accountability in the mainstream media.
You know, do you think, Arianna Huffington, that John McCain was someone who was a principled reformer who just sort of lost his way in his quest for power? Or do you think he's always been an opportunistic politician who simply had his ear to the ground for what would get him close to power, but really had no great values or commitment to anything whatsoever? And the reason I ask this question is that I think I've always wondered or often wondered why the political right disliked the guy so much, the Coulters and Hannitys and Limbaughs. And I think they just thought he was an opportunist and that, you know, now that, you know, he's coming around to their side opportunistically, they'll accept him, but grudgingly, but they don't trust him.
Well, I think that there's no question that John McCain was a real reformer. John McCain was a real independent voice, a real leader. No question about that in my mind at all. I spent a lot of time with him in New Hampshire on the Strait of Express at the Shadow Convention when he very bravely agreed to keynote that event, which was a convention that I helped organize in Philadelphia to basically challenge the Republican Party the way our convention in Los Angeles challenged the Democratic Party to address important issues on campaign finance reform, poverty, the failed war on drugs that they were not addressing. Now, that was a great statement on behalf of McCain, that he came there and addressed the convention even though George Bush himself had personally asked him not to. So that's why actually his fall from grace is so sad, that this is not just Mitt Romney, you know, who would say anything to get elected. This is not just a usual Paul who doesn't really believe in anything and therefore will say anything his pollsters or consultants are telling him to say.
Well, who is the real McCain? I mean, I guess that's the question I'm still struggling with to try to understand, having read not only your book, but other books about McCain and articles. You know, what does he actually stand for at the bottom?
Well, right now he stands for power. Right now he stands for doing anything and saying anything to win the White House. But the McCain of 2000 was a very different story.
And do you think there's any chance that if he does get power, he will then, once safely ensconced in the White House, he will become the McCain of 2000?
Oh, trust me, I'm not going to take that risk. I think that we have to deal with the McCain of 2008 and make sure he does not get power. I don't know what happens to a man after he has sold his soul to get elected. I don't know what's left. I doubt that the McCain of 2000 can come back.
You know, one of your comments that you made recently in an interview with Stephen Colbert that I saw was that war, you said, was McCain's Viagra.
Yes, I just kind of have heard him talk about the war in such terms. You know, there was a speech that he gave where he was going on about my friends were going to be at war, my friends, there will be more wounded. And the way he was talking about it was almost strange Lovian.
Yeah. Do you think, the press coverage of McCain, you've already referred to it, Arianna, it has tended to be throughout his career glowing. And I had a guest on the program a couple of weeks ago, Paul Waldman, who wrote the book with David Brock, sort of chronicling what they call the free ride that John McCain's gotten from the media. Do you think that is going to change now that journalists will respond to the new McCain much the way you have? I mean, journalists who fell in love with him in the 90s and his 2000 race are going to sort of get to the altar now and say, wait, why am I doing this?
You know, we have to really look at what he's saying right now. And I know that you are trying to see, you know, maybe he can go back to how he was. But right now we have to look at what John McCain is saying on issue after issue, whether it is immigration, when he said he would not even be voting for his own bill, on tax cuts. Remember, he called the tax cuts that George Bush had proposed, you know, so wrong, so unpalatable to him, that he said that he could not in good conscience vote for them, and now he wants to make them permanent. Even on torture, for me that was perhaps the final surrender, a man who had been tortured himself, deciding that to vote against the bill that would have prevented the CIA from using torture. This is now who John McCain has become, and that's why I think we have to have a big job of educating the American people and the American media as to who the new John McCain is.
And I'd also be interested in your take, Arianna Huffington, on the Democratic candidate or presumptive candidate at this point. I think it's safe to say Barack Obama. And a little bit, I'd like your take, if I could get it, on the Democratic presidential races here. For starters, say last November, December, did you think Obama was the likely nominee?
No. I hoped he would be the likely nominee because I think the country would do well to have someone who is a clear departure from the past and who did not vote for the war in Iraq. I think that's a major, major issue. Even though he was not in the Senate and therefore could not vote, he spoke out so eloquently and passionately against the war. I happened to be in a room in Los Angeles before he was elected when he spoke about the war in a way that so echoed the feelings of those of us who knew what a tragic mistake it would be. So I feel as we're headed to November, it will be great to have Obama against McCain because we'll be able to draw a very, very clear contrast between John McCain, who voted for the war and supported the war and the surge as passionately, if not more, than George Bush, and a man who knew from the beginning that the war in Iraq was an immoral and unnecessary war. I think no matter how bad the economy gets, the war and national security will still remain the critical issues of this election. And so having that sharp contrast, I think, is going to be very significant.
Hillary Clinton came under considerable criticism at the Huffington Post website over the past couple months for the way she conducted her campaign against Obama and the race for the Democratic nomination. What's your take on Hillary Clinton today compared to what it would have been if you'd been asked this question 5 months ago?
Well, I think that when Hillary Clinton used the fear card, I was concerned. You know, the fear card, fear-mongering, as I say in the book, has been one of the ways in which the right has been able to stay in power, especially in 2004. I mean, it was only by fear-mongering and presenting John Kerry as someone who would not keep us safe that George Bush got reelected. So the 3 a.m. ad, the ad on the eve of the Pennsylvania election, when we had, you know, the picture of Osama bin Laden return, are troubling to me because I think terrorism is a real threat to America and should not be used for partisan advantage in a way that makes the American people fear that the other candidate will not keep them safe.
Our guest today, Media Matters, is Arianna Huffington, the editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, which you can find online at huffingtonpost.com. Also the author of the brand new book, her latest of 12 books, Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe, and What You Need to Know to End the Madness, a book I've had the privilege of reading over the last few days. And as I told Arianna off air, a real pleasure to read. Extremely funny at points. It just flows along. And you're done with it before you started, and it's 300 pages long. So I recommend it to anyone interested in politics, and I know that most people listening to this program have a strong interest. We're pre-recording this show shortly before going on air, so please don't try to call in today. Just sit back, relax, and let us run the show here for the next half hour or so. Arianna Huffington, on Barack Obama again, it seemed like to me that the news media was, and I don't think I'm the only one who's had this conclusion, I think it seemed like to everyone, that the news media for the past 2 months, certainly since the Wisconsin primary in mid-February, has went through about a two-month period of just pounding him on Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Bill Ayers, flag lapel, bitter, a series of bizarro stories that became sort of food for the 24/7 cable news cycle. This was a bunch of real body blows he had to take. What do you think of that period? What does it say about our journalism, and how do you think Obama handled it?
Well, I think Obama has been made a better candidate as a result of all these attacks. But the media have come out of it really showing all of us how incredibly influenced they have been by the right-wing messaging of the last few years. I mean, just take the ABC debate that I've written about. To have such a large part of the debate dominated by issues which are fabricated issues of the right, you know, equating patriotism with wearing a flag lapel pin, or the obsession with Reverend Wright, or whether Barack Obama knew a 60s radical, at a time when the war in Iraq is catastrophe, when millions of Americans are threatened by foreclosure. This is really something which shows that the mainstream media are really not doing their job in pursuing the issues that Americans really care about, and instead getting completely distracted by sideshows.
And do you think that this is going to be what we'll be seeing a lot of, in the fall, come September and October? Are we going to basically have 2 months of this sort of garbage, or is there some way we can prevent that?
Well, I think there is. I think it's great that there are independent media with a greater megaphone than before, you know, whether it's the Huffington Post or you or George Marshall and Talking Points Memo, or Daily Kos. You know, there are many different ways at the moment for us to get our news and also for us to keep important stories alive. And so there is a countervailing force to the way the mainstream media are covering the news and are covering the race.
Do you think also, though, Arianna Huffington, that perhaps the fact that Hillary Clinton, in a way, did Obama a favor by raising and dignifying these issues in February, March, and April, that sort of are going to be old news come September and October?
Yes, and of course part of it will depend again on how the media handle them and how the Obama campaign handles them. I really am longing for Obama and other Democratic leaders to start dictating the game more.
Mm-hmm.
That Obama theoretically could have turned to Stephanopoulos and Charlie Gibson and said, you know, shame on you. These issues are not the issues that need to dominate this campaign. And the public would love that. You know, the public is tired of gimmicks. I mean, which is why the Hillary Clinton gas tax holiday did not exactly work. The public knew it was a gimmick. And there's a longing at the moment for truth-telling. On the eve of North Carolina, Obama said, we need to tell the American people the truth forcefully, repeatedly, and consistently. And I think that is really the message of this election. It's a different kind of moment in history. And the people who are running the old kind of messages are letting the public down more than at any other time.
Are you surprised that we're having a conversation here in 2008 about an African-American possibly being elected president of the United States? I mean, would you have thought this possible 10 or 15 years ago?
Yes, you know what, I really don't think that that electing an African-American would be such a huge problem as many people who look at the remnants of racism in the country believe, because even though there are remnants of racism, I think there are so many more people who are excited by this candidacy and by the historic significance of it, that they will more than compensate for the racist elements. I think that there are unprecedented numbers of registrations, of young people coming out to vote, of African-Americans voting. So I think, again, the media need to stop obsessing with that swing vote, that swing voter element. You know, the voters that somehow we need to always try and bring to the fold, instead of looking at the 50% of Americans who don't vote in a presidential election and trying to inspire and convince them to start voting.
Recently in the Huffington Post, you ran a piece speculating on who might be picked as Barack Obama's vice presidential choice. If Obama were to give you a phone call this afternoon and ask you for your short list or your choice, who would be on it?
You know, I like the idea of somebody like Jim Webb, who is a veteran who has taken some very strong stands on against the war and on veteran issues. He might even be willing to do something really bold and different, like go to Chuck Hagel,
the Republican, former Republican,
but
yeah.
Perhaps the most eloquent and consistent conservative critic of the war, to demonstrate that opposition to the war is not a left-wing or progressive issue. It's a mainstream issue. It's what is right for the country and for our own safety. Democrats are always worried about national security and how they are perceived as being weak on national security. So they need to make it very clear that to be strong on national security is to take on the real enemies and not trap the American military in a war that it cannot win.
In the book, Arianna Huffington, in your new book, Right is Wrong, that just came out that we're talking about today, you go through a series of the issues and discuss the right-wing position and issues, and I think demonstrate fairly convincingly that these are not popular positions with most Americans. And one of the issues you talk about that you've already mentioned is the economy and economics. And I'm wondering, in your view, and I know you know quite a bit about economics, in your view, do you think the problems with the American economy are primarily the result of Bush administration policies, or do you think they go to much deeper problems that involve both Republicans and Democrats and even maybe go beyond what politicians control?
I think, as I say in my chapter on the economy, that the right tax cut cult and obsession with a free, unregulated market have a huge responsibility for where we are with the economy right now. We have basically tax cuts in the middle of the war. We have more and more foxes guarding the hen houses and the weakening of so many regulatory agencies, whether it's the mining industry or the Product Safety Commission or OSHA. You know, again and again, this administration has shown its contempt for regulations, including when it came to the housing market, which is why we're now seeing the tragedy of over 2 million foreclosure notices and the tragedy of so many Americans losing their homes. So at the same time, the hypocrisy of the right is demonstrated when Bear Stearns is threatened to go bankrupt, and and immediately the right forgets about the whole idea that the free market will take care of everything, and rushes to demand that the government step in and save Bear Stearns.
You know, along those lines, Arianna Huffington, it seems, you know, when you see something like that, the government throwing $30, $50, $100 billion to bail out a company to prevent a financial crisis, or to even extend it to your discussion in the book on the cost of the war in Iraq, a couple trillion dollars at least, according to Joe Stiglitz, possibly $3 or $4 trillion for this war. And you see this money thrown out without any debate or consideration by the Bush administration or the political right. And then you see them squandering over whether you're going to spend $50 or $100 or $200 million on a school lunch program and saying that we can't afford that. It sort of makes you go dizzy, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, not even just the school lunch program, but also veterans' benefits. I mean, this is the party, this is the right that supposedly cares so much for the troops and constantly attacks Democrats for not supporting the troops. And yet they're the ones who are not even willing to take care of the troops, either when they send them to war without armor, the proper armor, or when they come home wounded and we don't have the proper resources to take care of them. You know, you even have John McCain saying that he will not vote for the new GI Bill.
Yeah, I see that too. And maybe you could give a little background of that for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the story, because regrettably this story has not gotten the same sort of attention as, you know, what Jeremiah Wright eats for breakfast. But would you just explain that a little more, Arianna?
I'm sorry, you mean which particular thing?
The veterans bill that Jim Webb...
Oh, yes. But, you know, this is Jim Webb, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think he would be such a great vice presidential candidate, has taken the lead in the new GI Bill, which would basically make it possible for vets to get a proper education. And that's after all is one of the most successful programs, that the government programs, when it comes to our veterans. And yet John McCain has said he will vote against it. And we have at the moment the battle in Congress about expanding other vets' benefits. And again, the right is fighting them. And there are even some blue dog Democrats who are fighting them, because they're saying that we don't have a revenue source for them. But what is the revenue source for the so-called emergency appropriations for Iraq? You know, that's also why I think Democratic leaders here are letting us down. There is a section in the book, as you know, where I talk about the way that the lack of Democratic leadership has been also responsible for the way the right has dominated our debate and our policy. And we see this example again on the Hill now, with blue dog Democrats willing to just vote for the new emergency appropriation on Iraq, but not willing to vote for extending unemployment benefits or benefits to veterans.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Arianna Huffington, author of the brand new book, Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution and Made Us All Less Safe, and What You Need to Know to End the Madness. We're taping this 10 days or so before going on air, so please do not call in today. Just sit back and relax for the final 15 minutes or so of the program. My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters, and this is WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Arianna Huffington, one of the topics you talk about in the book, which I found really interesting, which was a hot-button issue in the Republican primaries, not on the Democratic side, and I'm wondering if it'll return this fall, is the issue of immigration. And you cover this not only in terms of the politics of it by Republicans, but also the way the news media, in particular Lou Dobbs, have covered this issue.
Yes, again, it is fascinating to me how Lou Dobbs, who has consistently misled the American public on this issue, right down to claiming that increases in cases of leprosy, which in fact had not happened, were due to illegal immigration, again, is not held accountable. It's like he could say things like that on his show, be proven wrong, and then just plow on as though there's no demand for accountability. And this is CNN. It's not Fox. Glenn Beck is someone else who is constantly scaring the American public over immigration, and again, without any accountability.
You know, what you talk about, you just mentioned Lou Dobbs and Glenn Beck. It's not just Fox that has people pushing a particular right-wing political agenda. And we've seen the emergence in the last few years on MSNBC of Keith Olbermann, who's sort of providing a progressive or more liberal take on the day's affairs. But given the polling and the ratings, actually, that Olbermann's getting, are you surprised there aren't more voices like him on the mainstream news media?
You know, if you look at the ratings, you know, they're pretty insignificant compared to how many millions of Americans there are.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's the ratings. I think there's the, you know, Lou Dobbs' ratings improved when he started ranting about immigration. But again, we're not talking about huge numbers. I mean, you know, the Huffington Post has over 10 million unique visitors a month. So I think that you can reach people all across the country without without having to lie and mislead them about immigration or Osama bin Laden or any of the issues that Glenn Beck or Lou Dobbs or those at Fox, you know, tend to pick in order to drum up the sort of passions of the American people.
You know, I'd like to just turn, Arianna Huffington, in our closing section of the program to a few big picture issues. And I'm just interested, you've been in the United States for how long now?
I moved here from England in 1980. So what, 28 years?
28 years. So, you know, I'm always interested when I have guests who come to the United States from other countries to sort of get their take on the United States. And one question I have for you is, you know, how has the United States changed in the 28 years you've been here?
Well, I think that the most troubling change has been in the way that I describe in the book, the way we have allowed the right to hijack our democracy and to hijack our policies and our debate. And I think what has been tragic about that has been that we enabled it, that we in the media, democratic leaders, enabled this takeover. And it's particularly dangerous, as you know, in a time when our national security is threatened, to use fear to manipulate the public. You know, of course, George Orwell wrote brilliantly about it in 1984, but we've seen how the right has used fear since 9/11 to manipulate the electorate. And so in the face of that, it's all the more important that that Democrats and independents and disaffected Republicans tell the truth to the American public and really stand up to the right. I mean, it's a little bit like the Yeats poem, you know, that the worst are full of passionate intensity and the best lack all conviction. We see that a lot, and so I'm hoping that in the lead up to the election, there will be a lot more standing up and telling the truth.
Do you think that the Reagan era, or President Reagan specifically, was really the beginning of the current process? Or do you think were he around and had all his faculties today, he would be concerned by the way the Republican Party has gone?
I think that something happened since 9/11, which basically allowed the worst elements of the right to hijack the party and hijack the country. You know, the Rush Limbaughs and Ann Coulters and on the elected official front, the Dick Cheneys, would really not have had the power they had were it not for 9/11. I think that's what allowed them to get away with not just invading Iraq, but shredding the Constitution, warrantless wiretapping, limiting our civil liberties, all those things would not have been possible were it not for the manipulation of 9/11.
Indeed. I mean, you make the point, you've made it in the show, you make it in your book, that the policies that the right is pushing, be it in healthcare, which you talk about at length, or energy, or the war on evolution and science, are not popular at all with the vast majority of Americans. Yet these are the policies that John McCain looks like he's either endorsing directly or he's, you know, winking and nodding toward. How could he possibly get elected in this context?
Well, simply because the public still thinks of him as the McCain of 2000. I mean, but this is the paradox. You're absolutely right. You have 60 to 70% majorities on what used to be seen as left-wing positions, you know, on healthcare, on Iraq, on global warming. The center basically has shifted. The right has been discredited. But at the moment, that new center has not been clearly defined by our leaders. And that's the work that needs to be done between now and November. That's what I'm arguing in the book, because I believe that if we don't do a good job, we could again, outrageous though it may seem, lose in November and see the extension of the Bush legacy and the Bush policies through John McCain.
The polling numbers we're seeing, that you just talked about them, are fairly extraordinary, and they're quite unusual, especially among political allegiance of people under 29 years old in the United States, which has shifted dramatically away from the Republican Party in the past 5 years or so, to levels that have not been seen for decades. Do you think we might be in the middle of a fundamental realignment politically in this country?
I believe we are in the middle of a fundamental realignment.
And where is it realigning to? Yeah.
What?
Where is it realigning to, do you think?
Well, I think we're realigning in the sense that there is a new center emerging, that the right has the bankruptcy of the right, both in terms of our economy, in terms of foreign policy, is absolutely obvious. And the only way that the right can remain in power is through the Trojan horse of John McCain, through a candidacy of a political figure who has been seen for years by the media as an exceptionally independent thinker. And that's really the job ahead, to prove unequivocally that independent thinker is no more.
Do you think that, let's assume for a second that John McCain loses this election and the Republicans lose even worse in the House and Senate in 2008, and it continues for another election cycle, at least through 2010, do you anticipate that there will be a real change in the Republican Party, or do you think that these entrenched forces are so strong inside the party, that what you call the lunatic fringe, that they're really going to be going, they're going to be at the steering wheel for a long time, no matter what?
Well, I would be very interested to see what Chuck Hagel is going to do. He's not running for re-election, but I think he's a very significant figure. There are others in the House, like, including Walter Jones. Remember Walter Jones,
mm-hmm.
who wanted to indeed rename French fries Freedom Fries, was one of the first voices against the war in Iraq. So there are many voices within the Republican Party, not enough of them as eloquent and as consistent as Chuck Hagel. The question is whether they will be willing to redefine the party and take it away from the lunatic fringe that has hijacked it.
Or just abandon it, which is what, you know, the Lincoln Chafees seem to be doing.
Yes, or just abandon it.
And, you know, we only have a couple minutes left, Arianna Huffington, and there's a question I've wanted to ask you for some time, which is, you've lived in Greece, your native country, and in Britain before coming to the United States, and you're a fairly cosmopolitan person. What do you think most foreigners don't understand about the United States, people who've never been here? What do you think that the misconception about America is around the world, if you could generalize?
Well, when I was growing up in Greece, you know, America was revered. You know, I remember walking to school by a statue of Truman, and there was that sense that America was the greatest country in the world. I mean, so many Greeks wanted to emigrate to America. And now the spread of anti-Americanism abroad is really troubling and disturbing. And one of the reasons why having Barack Obama as president would be great news for America is the impact it would have abroad. You know, overnight, the view of America would change. I think the fact that we re-elected George Bush made a lot of people abroad question what's happened to America.
Along those lines, do you think, were Obama to be elected in November, that at a diplomatic level, the United States would have an ability to negotiate peace in the Middle East that it currently does not have?
Listen, I mean, there are huge problems, as we all know, in the Middle East. And the one thing that Barack Obama would be able to do is once again give the United States a real strategic diplomatic role, which our cowboy in the White House has considered kind of beneath him.
Arianna Huffington, we've only got about a minute left, and I'd just like to conclude finally, because we haven't spoken much about the Huffington Post, which is really an extraordinary phenomenon of media in itself, and I hope your 13th book might be on the Huffington Post. Just for the sense of our listeners who might not be familiar with it or have only visited the site a few times, can you give a sense of when it began and how quickly you've grown and what your plans are for the future?
Yes, the Huffington Post, which is now 3 years old, was, you know, born on May 9, 2005, to bring together many voices on the blog. We now have 2,000 contributors, 24/7, constantly refreshed news, a vibrant community, and now increasingly reporting. We have a team of reporters breaking news, run by Tom Etzel from the Washington Post. We launched many new verticals, many new sections beyond politics, you know, living, entertainment, media, business.
Arianna, where does the money come from to pay for this? How can you support something like this?
We both through advertising and through venture capital. And our latest project is Off the Bus, which is a citizen journalism project that I'd like to invite any of your listeners who want to participate to let Amanda Michelle, who is our project director, Amanda at HuffingtonPost.com, know about it, because we have about 2,000 contributors around the country and have had some great successes in reporting news and breaking news and giving the color of our political campaign.
Arianna Huffington, on that note, I have to say thank you so much for taking an hour of your very valuable time to join us here at Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you on the air.
Thank you so much.